Good evening. Welcome to Youth Beat Radio here on 98.3 and 102.1 FM here on WCRS Community Radio for Columbus. I'm Nishant Makija. It's a pleasure to have you with us on this Monday evening. The time in Columbus, Ohio is 7:30 p.m. Tonight, our first feature on the program starts with David Rod Hamill telling his story on how prison has changed his outlook on life, family, and his legacy. Next on Youth Beat Radio, we take a look at homework and how effective it is towards students' academic success. Third on the program, we take a look at the triumphant victory of an Upper Arlington alumni's battle with a rare form of cancer. And finally on Youth Beat Radio, do you find yourself needing that extra cup of coffee? Are you constantly checking your phone for any apparent reason? We take a look at these urgencies and how these urgencies can be considered addictions. That's coming up tonight here on Youth Beat Radio, here on 98.3 and 102.1 FM, WCRS Community Radio for Columbus. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. You are listening to Youth Beat Radio here on 98.3 and 102.1 FM, WCRS Community Radio for Columbus. I'm Nishant Makija. It's a pleasure to have you with us here again tonight on this Monday evening. We're going to begin Youth Beat Radio tonight with reporters Clara Rodhamel and Maddie Reitzel from here at Youth Beat Radio on the story of David Rodhamel and how prison has changed his life.
David Richard Rodhamel was born February 13, 1965, and he grew up as a regular boy in a small town by the name of Hudson, Ohio, very similar to Upper Arlington, with one younger brother and two sisters. He describes his enjoyable childhood as a very idyllic experience, mainly due to the family-like atmosphere of the neighborhoods of Hudson. He was an accelerated student and athlete, playing football, basketball, and baseball in high school. He initially attended Kenyon College, where he played basketball and baseball, and majored in economics. He then transferred to Ohio State University his junior year and graduated early that spring. He continued on to law school at OSU. While also in college, he met his future wife, Cindy Shilliday, and they wed in October of 1991, and despite studying law in college, Dave started a career in commercial real estate.
Along the way, Cindy and I had three beautiful daughters. Lily was born in 1994, 3 years after we were married. Claire was born in 1997, and Eleanor in 1999. Those three young ladies really became the focus of our lives in terms of pretty much everything we did. I was fortunate enough to have the flexibility at work to be able to spend a lot of time with my girls, and most of the things I did were oriented toward doing what I believed was the most important job as a parent, and that is, you know, making my girls better people than my wife and I were. And I spent a lot of time with all three of my daughters, traveling quite a bit. I think with my wife and my daughters, we've been in 9 or 10 or maybe more countries. And I really feel that those experiences have shaped my girls. Probably my favorite place on the whole earth. I mean, we've been to some great places and stayed in some great places, but probably my favorite place on this whole earth is Disney World. It makes me feel like a kid again every time I'm there. I love to watch the videos of my kids with the characters and the unfettered joy that just an optimism and enthusiasm that surrounds that place. I always worked my schedule, no matter how important my obligations were around their events and their activities so that I could be there. And I feel like I spent a lot of time with them. Like a lot of real estate developers, in 2008-2009, I was highly leveraged and stretched pretty thin, and we had a rather complicated structure in terms of interlocking partnerships and cross obligations and commingling of funds and things like that. Probably, in retrospect, not the smartest way to structure these things, which is, as a trained lawyer, I should have been more attuned to. But when the real estate market took a nosedive in 2008-2009 and some of our projects became illiquid and cash-strapped, I was accused of commingling funds and taking money from certain projects with certain clients that were partners and or clients of ours. And a series of events that were reported pretty prominently in the local press, including 4 days in a row in 2009 on the front page of the Columbus Dispatch, a pretty formidable wave of public opinion led to several indictments, many of which were dropped, but a couple of which turned into charges that I was eventually convicted of. On December 27th, 2010, after having a two-week trial in November and a week of jury deliberations, after which I was acquitted of the most serious of charges but convicted of several others, including money laundering and a bank fraud piece, I was sentenced to 6 years in prison. And despite what my attorney told me, I was taken right from the courtroom on that early afternoon, right to jail, without even having a chance to talk to my daughters, Lily, Claire, and Eleanor, about it.
The biggest memory that's in my head of the whole like trial and the sentencing and all that is like having to come home and tell the girls, which it was December 27th. It was 2 days after Christmas. It was Christmas break. They were like with their friends, you know, running around, and they all came home at like different times. And I think that was probably the hardest part, was just, I'm just having to tell them.
Prison is just a one day at a time endeavor. We have freedom of movement within the prison. I spend my days reading, writing, praying, and trying to contribute what I can to any of the other inmates in here to try as best I can to continue to be a productive father for my three girls. I'm not even sure how long I would have lasted in here without the support and love of my family. My daughters, the three of them, wrote me letters the first week I was in prison, and basically those letters saved my life, and I'll always be thankful to them for that, and I further hope that they use my experience as motivation, not as an excuse for anything, but as motivation. They've held their chins up. They've all told me they're not going to let my circumstances define them. They're going to become stronger for it and use it as a catalyst to help others. And for that, I'm really proud of them and I love them. And I also truly believe that my situation that has befallen me, part of which I created, a lot of which I created, someday, somehow, will become a positive for someone. I don't know if I'm going to know about it when it happens or if I'm going to know to whom or for whom it happens, but I truly believe that something positive will come of it, will come of this. It's not how many times you get knocked down. It's how many times you get up and what you do once you get up. I'm trying not to let this atmosphere, you know, it can dampen my spirit, but I'm trying not to let it change my soul. But when I get out, I just want to be in a position to hit the ground running, and as I say, pay forward in some way. I'm not sure how I'm going to do it, but pay forward in some way the positive emotions and the wishes and the support that I've gotten in here. But the most important thing I want to do is just honestly is contribute something to people. I mean, I've certainly had my share of notoriety. I won't call it fame. I'll call it notoriety. I'm not looking for more notoriety. I'm just looking to try to leave some part of our world, you know, better than I found it. Hi, Bear.
Hi,
Happy
Dad.
Birthday. Love you.
You're never in the
I love you tons.
Wow. What a powerful story. There is a lesson to be learned here. Next on Youth Beat Radio, do you like homework? Well, this story may make you think twice. Youth Beat Radio's reporters Kristen Bobenberger has this story.
Students shuffle through the hallways, dreary-eyed and hunched over. They carry backpacks seemingly filled with bricks. This image is not exclusive to Upper Arlington High School. Students all over the nation face an extensive workload every day, only to go home and continue to work at night. Ryan McClure, principal of Upper Arlington High School, shares his opinion on the matter.
The ultimate goal is to reinforce the instruction in the classroom or for students to show that they understand a concept. But I think the big thing with homework is that it's meaningful.
Upper Arlington High School 9th grade teacher Mark Besch shares his own thoughts on homework and how it affects the students.
I think sometimes homework can be very stressful to students, especially if it's piled on. For me, I understand that you have 5, 6, maybe 7 other classes that you're taking in the course of a day, and it could have homework for those classes as well.
In 2004, the University of Michigan conducted a survey of roughly 3,000 students ages 6 to 17. They found that time spent each week on homework had increased from 2.5 hours to 4 hours since 1981. Harris Cooper, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, found a few connections between the amount of homework and academic achievement. He concluded that the increase in homework is not necessary. In this sense, Besch agrees with Cooper.
In regards to how much homework I assign per week, it varies, but I don't do more than, I don't know, half an hour every other night. Quite frankly, I'm not a big homework person.
The National Education Association recommends 10 minutes of homework per grade level. This means a 9th grader would have on average 90 minutes of homework a night. McClure talks about how this homework policy is hard to follow.
All right, the homework policy, I think it's a tough one to follow because with the emphasis on projects and tests, but I think the actual policy of how many hours per week that we should have students studying for one class, I would hope is adhered to in each of the classes that students have.
Students at Upper Arlington High School share how many hours of homework they have per night.
Orban Sturgill, 12th grade, probably 2 to 3.
Maggie Hobson, 11th grade, like 2 hours of homework a night.
Anna Cotterman, and I'm a senior. I have like 4 hours of homework.
Sarah Steckinger, grade 10, I do about 2 hours of homework.
Like many other students, junior at Upper Arlington High School, Rachel Piscopo, feels overwhelmed about the amount of homework given to her.
Sometimes, like when I have way too much homework at night, it stresses me out so much that I just decide to almost quit and just not do any of the homework because I almost feel like it's not worth it.
Alfie Cohn, graduate of Brown University and author of The Myth of Homework, says that homework shows only an association, not a relationship, with academic achievement. In other words, it is hard to justify the increase in the amount of homework given. Rachel Piscopo supports Cohn's statement.
I feel like a lot of the homework that we do could be helpful, but because it is given to us in masses, it is just more stressful than helpful.
Tilly Fountain, a freshman at Upper Arlington, agrees with Cohn and Piscopo.
Our teachers should just cut down like the amount of homework they give us if they do give us homework, because sometimes it's overwhelming.
Fountain also feels that homework can lead to larger problems than stress.
Like, school sometimes can just put so much pressure on kids that they'll will end up having like depression or like anxiety or like any other disorders. So I think that teachers should just all like communicate with each other better. And same with like tests and quizzes, like just space things out and give them like a longer time frame to at least be able to turn things in.
Over time, standards have been raised, which led to an increase in the amount of homework given to students. The idea of homework is to help students. However, the concept has been taken too far. Homework is the key to learning, but there are other aspects that can help create well-rounded students. McClure elaborates on this.
We want to have well-rounded students. You know, we want their life to be well-rounded besides something that's work, and when they get older, that they have hobbies and things that they can follow and have passions in life outside of work.
For YouthBeat Radio, this has been Kirsten Bomberger for Allie Graver, Sarah Richards, and Julia Anderson.
Thanks, Kirsten. So glad my days of homework are over. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will take a look at how an alumni of Upper Arlington turned his battle with cancer into victory. We'll be right back. You are listening to YouthBeat Radio here on 98.3 and 102.1 FM on WCRS Community Radio for Columbus. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. You are listening to YouthBeat Radio here on 98.3 and 102.1 FM. WCRS Community Radio for Columbus. I'm Nishant Makija here again. Next here on YouthBeat Radio, YouthBeat Radio reporters Evan Manani and Wayne Brown talk with Jared Sylvester about his compelling and triumphant story.
My name is Jared Sylvester, 24 years old, and I'm a former graduate of Upper Arlington High School. Graduated in 2008. During my time at Upper Arlington, my focus and my identity was obviously as a student, but even more so as an athlete. I was highly involved in the football program and lacrosse program at the high school. Actually, when I was at school, we each year won states for lacrosse. So that was a great part of my life, great part of my friendships came out of both of those sets of teams, football and lacrosse team. And a lot of my life was revolved around the work ethic discipline that was built into the athletic structure in my life back then. After graduating from Upper Arlington in 2008, I left for Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where I planned to study business, ended up majoring in both history and business. And in my third year, first semester of my junior year, I was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer, osteosarcoma. I came back from fall break to get a checkup with a doctor because my leg had been hurting for months. I'd been training for a half marathon and there was an immense amount of pain that was built up that I kept on ignoring. But I couldn't put it off any longer. I came home for fall break and got an MRI and received the most unlikely news possible, that I was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. From there, we dropped out of school right away. That was first priority. Second was to meet with all my doctors and healthcare physicians that I had just met the previous week, work through a game plan of what was to come. They told me right away that I would have to get a limb salvage surgery, which would consist of taking out my knee, taking out the tumor that was in my distal femur, and placing metal rods and plastic rods into my knee from mid-thigh to mid-tibia. They told me that I would have to go through a year-long of chemotherapy treatment to make sure that the cancer was gone and removed from my body, and they also told me that I would never run again. I think that having heard all that information unloaded and unpacked within a matter of days, obviously it was an emotional, overwhelming fact in my life, completely unexpected. So lots of prayer, lots of talking, and lots of family time, and a lot of tears were shed. But I think the thing that impacted me most was that I wasn't going to be able to run. So having heard that news that I would never run again was more devastating than the cancer were. I was diagnosed with osteosarcoma October 15th, 2010, and from there, did a year of treatment of chemotherapy. That's 23 rounds of intensive chemotherapy each week spent in the hospital, 1 week in, 1 week out, and multiple amounts of surgery. After coming out of treatment in the fall of 2011, I felt like I was celebrated at the hospital, celebrated with my family that I was out of treatment and now quote unquote cancer free, but you're thrown off this cliff into reality. And being a 22-year-old male, I had nowhere to go except home. I was a student at Miami before I was diagnosed, but entering back into the real world, there was no sense of identity with living in Columbus, not having a job, not pursuing an education. And so I was lost. I'm 24 now, 2 years out of chemo and treatment, and still cancer-free, praise the Lord. But it's a transitional period back into reality. I'm living at home because that's what's convenient for me. It works best. I have a system down. My family is very supportive and willing to take care of my needs, physically and health-wise. You know, I have scans every couple months, so that's on my mind. But other than that, just reclaiming parts of my life back. Even though I'll never be able to run again, I still consider myself an athlete. I like to participate in sports. I like to work out. I coach occasionally, and so I'm very highly involved in the things that I still love, the hobbies that were always mine before. They've just transitioned to a different perspective. Now that I'm on the sidelines rather than on the playing field itself, it still means the most to me. I am still who I am today as I was before. Just a lot of character development has changed in me. And a gratitude towards life and perspective change has happened. So I am Jared Sylvester, 24-year-old cancer survivor.
Jared will be scanned for cancer for the rest of his life. If his scans are clean for the next 2 years, the chance of the cancer coming back will decrease by 50%. Jared is now at The Ohio State University studying health sciences.
Thanks, Evan and Wynn. Very powerful story. Let's continue the fight against cancer. I think that is very important to do that. Finally tonight here on Youth Beat Radio, do you need that extra cup of coffee to get you through the day? Well, Youth Beat Radio's Caroline Bruce tells us how you might be suffering from a common day addiction.
Whenever we hear the word addiction, we usually think of drugs and alcohol. But addictions or obsessions can come in all different forms. There are a lot of things that we use every day that can become addictions. Some of these things include caffeine, phones, and exercise. How many people need that little jolt of caffeine from coffee to start their day? How many people drink soda and tea like it's water? These examples indicate a dependency on caffeine. We talked to Ohio State sports nutritionist Sarah Wick about caffeine's addictive qualities.
Caffeine is a very addictive product. It's a stimulant. So the problem, and because it's something that our body gets used to get that same stimulation, the people can tend to take more and more and more to get what they were having before.
Sometimes to break the habit, people will stop drinking caffeine and it can negatively affect them. According to multiple sites such as Energy Fiend, the top 10 symptoms of caffeine withdrawal are headaches, sleepiness, irritability, lethargy, constipation, depression, muscle pain or stiffness, lack of concentration, flu-like symptoms, and insomnia. According to Laura Giuliano, a psychology professor at American University, the symptoms of caffeine withdrawal overlap a lot with other disorders and medical problems. They've heard many times people went to the doctor for chronic headaches or because they thought that they had the flu, and it turns out it was caffeine withdrawal and they didn't even know it. Allie Graver, a student at Upper Arlington High School, shares the story of her mom going through these symptoms.
So every time my family goes on vacation, my mom likes to spoil herself by getting Diet Cokes at every single McDonald's we see. And so she'll end up having like 4 Diet Cokes a day. And then when we get home from vacation, she doesn't drink any. And then she has major migraines for like 4 days.
Another common day addiction that might catch you by surprise is the use of smartphones. Mm-hmm. As technology advances, people become more and more dependent on their phones. Acting as their security blanket, people carry their phones around with them everywhere. We talked to Claire Roadhamel, a UAHS student and avid iPhone user, about what her cell phone means to her.
My cell phone is basically my security blanket, and it makes me feel safe. Even when I don't have it, I feel just kind of out of touch.
Phones are now used for not only communication, but for things such as social media, photography, navigation, and school. These may seem like practical and helpful uses, but when has it gone too far? Clara talks about her experience with it.
I do sometimes have it in my pocket or something and think I got a notification or a message or something, and I look at it and I didn't, and I don't know why that happens.
Clara is not the only one who experiences this phenomenon. According to Dr. Michelle Druin, a professor of psychology in Fort Wayne, Indiana, 89% of the undergraduates in her study had experienced these phantom vibrations about every 2 weeks. Has it gone too far when it's affecting our psychological state? What about when it's affecting our sleep habits? We talked to Clara about this, too.
Okay, so sleep deprivation is a huge thing, too. I'll get in bed at like 10 or 10:30, and I'll say I'm going to get a good night's sleep, and then I find myself getting into the late hours at like 1 a.m., and I'm still on my phone just going through Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or anything.
So it is pretty obvious that in these ways our phones negatively affect us. But phones are not the only thing that, when done or used obsessively, can have a negative effect on us. Another thing is exercise. We all think of exercise as being something really good for our body, but when done obsessively, it can become very detrimental. Sarah Wick explains how obsessive exercise can go hand in hand with a type of eating disorder.
What happens with those people is, like, they count their calories, and mm-hmm. then they have to, they try to exercise how many calories they've eaten. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess there's all kinds of different ways. Some people just eat, and then they have to exercise. So they end up, if they eat three times a day, they exercise three times a day.
This is very unhealthy because we need to take in a certain amount of calories to be able to function in daily life. The key to proper exercise and eating is balance, and Sarah Wick helps to further explain this.
I think you need the combination, mm-hmm. and it's all in moderation.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to eat perfect all the time, and you're not going to be able to exercise every day. So I think that the key for exercise is moderation, so you don't get addicted to it. Maybe find a couple different things, but just to find something that's convenient for you.
All of these things can be good for a person in moderation, but allowing yourself to become addicted to anything can have a harsh impact on the body and the mind. Addictions aren't categorized only by drugs and alcohol. They can come in several different forms, such as caffeine, phones, and exercise. So the next time you pick up a cup of coffee, check your phone, or go to the gym, think about how big of a role this plays in your life.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm definitely going to try to stop checking my phone so much. Oh my goodness, that's going to be too hard for me to do, though, but I definitely should try to do that as much as possible. And that's going to wrap up things for Youth Beat Radio on this Monday evening. Thanks for being with us. I'm Nishant Makija. You can find us online at youthbeat.osu.edu or by checking us out on Facebook at Youth Beat Radio. Again, I'm Nishant Makija. Tune in next Monday again at 7:30 p.m. right here on WCRS Community Radio for Columbus on 98.3 and 102.1 FM. From all of us at Youth Beat Radio and WCRS, good night. Youth Beat Radio is produced by youth from Central Ohio high schools, youth groups, and universities. The show is supported by the School of Environment and Natural Resources at The Ohio State University, Ohio State University Extension, Puffin Foundation West, and local sponsors. The ideas expressed on tonight's program are not necessarily those of the station or the sponsors.